ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Australia's Pacific Development Labor Program, known as the PALM Scheme, is being accused of a form of modern slavery. Workers who've travelled to Australia from the Pacific have since left their jobs and say their employers were abusive and exploitative. The workers are now in visa limbo, unemployed and homeless. Many are finding refuge in rural communities around Australia. Lucy Cooper reports.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pinu found herself in dire circumstances.
I was left with nothing. I feel like sad. Yeah.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM Scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia by bringing in workers from the Pacific. After 11 months of irregular hours and poor pay as a fruit picker employed by a labour hire company, Susan Pinu says she had no choice but to leave her rural job. She's not alone. More than an estimated 7,000 PALM Scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which put some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive like zero take-home pay.
Dr. Kaya Barry of Griffith University is one of the report's authors. She says most workers had their visas cancelled after leaving their employer, and while some were able to obtain bridging visas, letting them work or study, those who remain undocumented no longer have a right to work in Australia or access to insurance, support or Medicare.
They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery.
Wayne Levy left his home in the Solomon Islands to work at a factory in Queensland under the PALM scheme.
At the end of the day, I just received, let's say, 200 and 300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home and they have to attend their education and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future.
Both Wayne Levy and Susan Pinu are now living in Leeton, a sun-drenched horticultural hub in the New South Wales Riverina region. Many disengaged workers end up in Leeton, with the promise of a strong job market and welcoming community.
They come here seeking friendship, connections, and some opportunities to work.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We support 100% the initiative and the framework of the PALM scheme, absolutely. But the failings we can't walk away from. We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened.
Paul is working with local employers to better support PALM scheme workers so that it can become a model for other places struggling with disengagement.
If someone does leave the scheme, they should not have any fear whatsoever that they will be persecuted in any way.
The report Dr. Kaya Barry co-authored is also calling for changes they say will keep more workers in the scheme.
There needs to be much more flexibility for people as individuals employed on the PALM scheme visa to actually have their say.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Federal Employment and Workplace Relations Minister, Amanda Rishworth, said the government's committed to the PALM scheme and is investing $440 million to improve and expand it. A department spokesperson also said the government has been strengthening protections for PALM scheme workers, including better workplace conditions.
Lucy Cooper reporting. As Australians continue to grapple with high energy prices, the federal government is preparing to unveil a new domestic gas reservation policy on the east coast, keep more Australia's gas onshore. It comes after rising energy costs recently pushed the government to commit billions of dollars to bail out gas-reliant smelters and steelworks. Political reporter Samantha Dick has the story.
If Australia has an abundance of gas, why are energy bills so expensive? Part of the answer is because we ship most of it overseas, and once reliable gas reserves are running empty.
Australia should be a manufacturing powerhouse. But it can't be if we're shipping our gas off overseas and paying exorbitant prices.
Paul Farrow is the National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, representing workers in heavy industries such as steel, manufacturing and construction. For more than a decade, the union has been pushing the government to create an East Coast gas reservation scheme to ensure Australia keeps more of its gas onshore and energy prices down.
The time to act was yesterday. Obviously, we can't wind back the clock, but we need to act now.
That time appears to have finally arrived, with the federal government poised to introduce a new domestic gas reservation policy on the East Coast by the end of the year. Gas producers have long argued that any domestic reservation policy should only apply to new projects to avoid compromising long-standing export contracts with overseas buyers such as Japan. Tony Wood is an energy and climate change senior fellow at the Grattan Institute think tank.
They have an expectation that they're going to continue to get gas under those contracts from Australia. So when they hear the possibility that Australia is going to intervene in those contracts, which they haven't so far, and I don't think they ever will, they get nervous.
Mr. Wood says the problem with applying a domestic reserve on new projects, such as the Beetaloo Basin gas field in the remote Northern Territory, is that many of them are located far away from the areas which need gas the most, particularly Victoria.
Beetaloo is a long way from the East Coast domestic market, and how we'd get that much gas into the East Coast market would be one of the problems that the government would have to solve.
The Coalition took a policy to the federal election to establish a gas reserve on the East Coast that would have applied to existing projects. Opposition Resources spokesperson Susan McDonald says that's no longer on the table.
The Coalition's view is that any reserve can only be prospective with a view to protecting contracts and investment.
This year, the Albanese government committed billions of taxpayer dollars to bailing out power-hungry steelworks and smelters, a move that Senator McDonald says was necessary but reflective of the issues plaguing Australia's energy market.
It is a direct result of the Albanese Labor government's failed energy policy, their rushed renewable policy.
But Paul Farrow says these problems have been brewing for years, to when the Coalition was in government. The union wants the government to set a price cap for industrial energy users like smelters to protect them from gas market spikes that leave them scrambling.
It comes back to giving that surety to industry.
With bipartisan support emerging for some sort of gas reservation policy, Paul Farrow says he's hopeful for Australia's manufacturing future.
We can offer a lot more to the world than just digging up stuff and shipping it overseas.
Paul Farrow, the National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, ending that report by Samantha Dick. Hobart will be getting a new sports stadium after Tasmania's upper house approved the development late last night. It comes after years of debate, and it now means the state's AFL team, the Devils, can enter the Codes competition for 2028. I spoke to ABC reporter Selena Bryan, who's in Hobart, a short time ago. Selena, the stadium has finally got the green light. What's the reaction been?
Well, look, there's been a lot of excitement on social media amongst Tasmanian football fans, at least. There is still some concern from people who are opposed to this project, but there has been a really overwhelming amount of outpouring of excitement and relief from a lot of people who were concerned that it might not get up. So a lot of excitement there from football fans. The AFL has put out a statement saying that today's a historic day in the short history of the Tasmanian Devils Football Club, and that it's an incredibly important outcome for everyone who's worked tirelessly to see a Tasmanian footy club compete on the national stage, and for the hundreds of thousands of Tasmanians who've stood behind the Devils with such passion and pride. But the vote didn't go through until 11 p.m. last night, so I expect that we'll see a lot more reaction as the day goes on today.
And it's been a long journey to get to today. Can you remind us why this stadium has been so contentious?
Yes, I mean, the contention has kind of come out a lot over the past few years. The site that it is planned for at Macquarie Point wasn't the original site, and then suddenly there was a deal a few years ago with the Premier and the AFL to move it to Macquarie Point, and there had been a plan for that site that included Aboriginal heritage and housing and things like that, that people saw as a real kind of broader community space that now will be an AFL stadium, you know, hosting other events as well. But there was also a Tasmanian Planning Commission assessment of the stadium that was scathing. And then the Premier, Jeremy Rockliffe, questioned those findings and chose to bypass that process by using specific stadium legislation to get it approved. There's also constraints for transport and moving the 23,000 people in and out, particularly when a game or event finishes. And then also concerns about the cost and the state's ability to afford that at this time. So the cost of the stadium at this stage is $1.13 billion, and that's increased over the past few years from $700 million. And to secure the support from the independents in the upper house, the government has promised that it would cap the state spend at $875 million. So there is still a lot to work through over the coming years, but construction set to start in about a year with the team to enter the AFL men's competition in 2028.
Selena Bryan in Hobart. The Pentagon's review of the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal highlights the importance of the United States, Australia and the United Kingdom meeting the agreement's deadlines. It comes as Australia's most senior diplomat in the UK and former Defence Minister Stephen Smith says he believes the AUKUS submarine deal will survive the Donald Trump presidency. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports from London.
The mammoth AUKUS pact between the UK, US and Australia has dominated Stephen Smith's time as Australia's most senior diplomat in Britain. As former defence minister and from the shipbuilding state of Western Australia, Mr Smith was tasked with making sure it was on a pathway to success.
Did the office do enough to secure or protect the agreement against the unpredictable whims of a Trump presidency?
Well, the Prime Minister did very well with President Trump, and as President Trump said in his meeting at the West Wing with the Prime Minister, so far as he's concerned with AUKUS, it's full steam ahead. So there's a big tick on that.
Do you think it will survive the Trump presidency?
Absolutely. No, I think there's, you know, if President Trump wanted to, inverted commas, stop AUKUS, he wouldn't have said it's full steam ahead.
His confidence comes despite all three countries involved in the agreement conducting reviews of it. And as Defence Minister Richard Miles received the findings of the Pentagon's much-anticipated probe into the $368 billion submarine deal. Initial fears the investigation would be sharply critical were eased during the Prime Minister's first face-to-face meeting with President Trump in October. Securing the release of Julian Assange from Belmarsh Prison also dominated Stephen Smith's time in the post. In 2023, he became the first Australian official to visit him since 2019.
We had to persuade the United States that they should relent on their extradition order and or come to an arrangement with Mr Assange and his lawyers.
But he never imagined the journey would see him escort Mr Assange to Saipan, where he would finally formalise a plea deal with US officials.
The Brits would not let him out of Belmarsh until the Westminster local court essentially accepted an undertaking by me that I would travel with him all the way until the completion of the court case in Saipan and hold his travel documents.
Before Mr Smith took up the posting, Australia's High Commission in London had a reputation for hosting plenty of parties. Mr Smith rejected the suggestion he was hired to clean up the bureau and batted off recent criticism aired in the media that he didn't host enough parties advocating for Australian businesses.
I think I'm the only Australian ambassador or high commissioner who's been criticised or accused of not partying enough.
Former South Australian Premier Jay Weatherall will replace Mr Smith, taking up the post in the new year. This is Catherine Deese in London, reporting for AM.
As Israel's president considers a formal pardon for the country's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over long-standing corruption charges, opinion across Israel is divided on whether it's the right approach. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Outside the Tel Aviv District Court, a small but noisy group wait for the Prime Minister's motorcade. One of the leaders of the protest, Ido, says their mission is simple.
And we're here to make sure that that justice is made and that he eventually will be sent to prison just like he deserves.
The protesters spot one of Benjamin Netanyahu's most prominent supporters, Tali Gottlieb from his Likud party. She's heckled as she approaches the courthouse to show her support, offering this assessment to the ABC as she enters the building.
She's
They should be ashamed of themselves for that pathetic demonstration.
For the last year, Benjamin Netanyahu has been appearing here for a couple of hours a day, a few days a week, giving evidence in his corruption trial.
Well, you have to remember that he said that he could do both things, right? Be a prime minister and stand trial.
Oren Persico is a staff writer with the independent Israeli media outlet The Seventh Eye and is one of a handful of journalists to be in the high-security underground court for most of Mr. Netanyahu's appearances, even though many have been cut short as he rushes off to deal with pressing matters of state.
Every time he gets a sealed envelope with notes to update him, and he says, I'm going to have to make a phone call, and he leaves.
Mr. Netanyahu is facing charges of bribery, fraud and breach of trust relating to three different cases. In the first, he's accused of receiving a supply of expensive gifts like champagne and cigars from billionaire businessmen, including Australian James Packer, who denies any wrongdoing. In the other two cases, it's alleged he promised legislative changes to benefit media moguls in exchange for favourable press coverage. He's always rejected the allegations, but now his lawyers have called on Israeli President Isaac Herzog to intervene and issue a pardon, emboldened by comments like these from the US President Donald Trump in the Israeli parliament in October.
Mr. President, why don't you give him a pardon?
Lawyer Iliad Schreger is the chairperson of the Movement for Quality Government in Israel and a vocal critic of the Prime Minister.
So you can't claim that you're innocent in one end and on the other end ask for pardon.
Moshe Kavarsky is a rank-and-file member of Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party and has been combing through the evidence against the Prime Minister along with others trying to debunk the charges.
We want the trial to be stopped not because of saving Netanyahu. We think he already proven his innocence. It's because it's wasting a lot of the country's resources in vain.
Even without a presidential pardon, there's no imminent end to the trial, which could run for a few more years, beyond the next election, due before October 2026. This is Matthew Doran in Tel Aviv, reporting for AM.
War photographers play an important role documenting conflicts around the globe. Lindsay Addario is one of the world's most famous war photographers and covers the world's flashpoints for the New York Times. Now the lens has been turned on Lindsay Addario herself in a new film. Nicole Johnston reports.
Daddy, where's my phone?
Mummy is working, Alfred.
God.
Is he downstairs?
We're all inundated by images of death and destruction and horror. And I think there's only so much that people can take.
This is Lindsay Addario. We're being shelled.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Lindsay Addario is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer for the New York Times. She's also the subject of a new film called Love Plus War. It's a front-row seat to the front lines of the world and deeply personal.
She'd go where most people wouldn't go in a million years.
Oh, geez. We've seen the change to drone warfare in Ukraine, also in Gaza. How much more dangerous does that make it?
Oh, I mean, it's extraordinary. I think drones have changed everything about the way we cover war and the way wars are fought. I think in Ukraine, drones have more than 25 kilometers range. And so, you know, no place is essentially safe because you can be driving in your car in a place where you think is safe and be killed by a drone.
A film has just been released on your life and the difficulty of trying to balance a family with the travel and the work. Do you think that is a universal story, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most beautiful feedback that I have received from the film is just the candor of the struggle to balance parenting and work. It doesn't matter what profession you're in. You know, for me, okay, I cover war and it's extreme. I go from being on the front line in Ukraine to trying to get to my son's music concert. And I think it was important to be transparent about how difficult it is and how this work also takes a toll on my children.
Does it leave you feeling helpless about the state of the world?
I really don't want to be depressed and give up hope in humanity because one of the reasons I keep going back is because the people I meet, even in the darkest places, are so incredibly resilient. They have hope. They're trying to push forward. They're trying to push through these difficult times. And I think that we as a public should not turn a blind eye and should not pretend that these things just are happening so far away that we can't pay attention.
Are you going to be a photographer like Mummy?
Yay!
Not allowed to be a photographer.
War photographer Lindsay Addario, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. The US has been building up its military forces in the Caribbean after months of deadly strikes on boats from Venezuela, it says, are smuggling drugs. Today, Latin America expert Orlando Perez on why Donald Trump is turning up the pressure on Venezuela's president and if it could edge the region towards conflict. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.